everyone. Thank you so, so much for coming on the Monday of the last week of term and for this sort of irregularly scheduled Women's Rights in the Middle East Research Seminar event. This is the last event in our term. Tomorrow we'll have a book talk, don't forget about that, with Dr. Atta Said, who's kindly here with us today as well. And you all probably know that we have another event, the last session of the Israel-Palestine seminar that we've had this term tonight at 5 as well. So make sure to show up for those too. So while you enjoy your lunch, I'll introduce our very dear guest, Dr. Amal Nazal. Dr. Nazal is an assistant professor at Bir Zeit University, and she received her PhD from the University of Exeter. Her work looks at the relevance of Bourdieu's theory of practice for relationally capturing various organizational practices, mechanisms, and dynamics in sociocultural organizations, and in particular, social movements. Her research interests include intersectionality theory, feminist organizing, social capital, social networking theory, and new social media and organizations. Her research is also driven by constructing realities and the perceptions of agents and social actors through incorporating different interpretive methods, which include in-depth interviewing and participant observation. She is also interested in new research methods such as digital ethnography and social media content analysis. We are very thrilled to have you here today. Please join me in welcoming Dr.
Thank you so much for attending this seminar. I'm really happy to be here and to take part of the Women's Right Research Seminars, and to be at Oxford University is such a privilege. And before I start anything and start in, before I start also introducing myself, I will just send my salute and your salute, I guess, to Gaza, to all the people that have been killed in Gaza and still are being killed in Gaza, to the mass starvation that's happening at the moment, and to the ongoing non-stop genocide that's happening in Gaza. Definitely after my presentation, I will be speaking more about this, because I don't think we can speak about any topic related to Palestine without speaking about Gaza and what's happening in Gaza on different levels and scales. My name is Amal Nazal. I was born in Palestine. I lived in Palestine. I went to schooling system in Palestine. I finished my bachelor degree in Palestine. Both mom and dad are from Palestine. And I finished my bachelor and my first master degree in Palestine. And then I went to Exeter, University of Exeter, where I finished my second master degree and my PhD. And then since 2016, I went back to Bir Zeit University. And I'm working at Bir Zeit University as an assistant professor, being engaged with different activism, communities and organizations, especially feminist activism, also in Palestine. And the context of this research started as a part of my PhD work, where after the Syrian and the Egyptian revolution started back in 2011, many Palestinian collectivities and communities started to go out to the streets and support revolutions in Syria and in Egypt. And lots have happened there, and because I was part of these communities, the feminist question of what's happening to the Palestinian women activists was very interesting for me to explore, because these women have experienced oppression and suppression both from the Israeli occupation and the Palestinian Authority and its apartheid security system, which is the Palestinian Security Forces, in different fashion and different shapes. So this is the context. Back in 2011, I interviewed around 43 Palestinian activists since then who have been participating in different activism in Ramallah, where I do live, and in Palestine, in the West Bank, which helped me to better understand what do we mean by Palestinian feminist organizing in Palestine. How do Palestinian women can participate in political activism and social activism? What are the obstacles, challenges, plus opportunities and privileges for some, which is the intersectionality kind of lens of looking at what's happening in terms of these different disadvantaged positions plus the privileges that some of these women do have. So, and I know that this is also a part of the International Women Day, and I would be very happy to speak about what a Palestinian woman day would mean to us as Palestinians, because it's not a struggle only against patriarchy in Palestine, which is also an Orientalist thought of what's happening in this country. Feminist struggles in Palestine are facing Israeli colonization and occupation, are facing also patriarchy and authoritarianism from the Palestinian Authority and its security forces. So I will be coming and crossing upon these different topics. So first of all, let me start by saying that we can't understand what's happening in Palestine now without understanding what's happening, what happened in the history. Even we can't understand what's happening in Gaza at the moment without understanding what happened back in time and how the Israeli colonization have started and ethnic cleansed also historic Palestine. So I will be touching upon the history of women movement and how it started. And then I will be also speaking about the emergence of the progressive leftist politicization and the progressive leftist political parties inside Palestine. There isn't much said about the left political parties in Palestine and how did they emerge in the 70s and how the left Marxist Palestinian political parties have affected resistance in general in Palestine and women issues in Palestine as well, which we are still witnessing in Palestine until now. I will be speaking about the Palestinian Authority that we have many problems with and about the creation of the Palestinian security forces and how was that built in collaboration with the US and the Israeli occupation to manage occupation from a very near point, which is near to the Palestinian social fabric, which will make it less costly for an occupier, just like to build and created this entity of oppression inside the West Bank, for example, just like to oppress, suppress, collect intelligence to silence people actually and stop any form of resistance. And I will be also a little bit talking about the NGOization of the Palestinian women movement. This is a flux that different women organizations now are facing. But how is this taking place, the NGOization taking place with the help and the politicized agenda of the international aid upon the Palestinian women case? And definitely there will be no talk without speaking about Gaza and without speaking about what's happening in Gaza a moment from a feminist perspective and from a non-feminist perspective, from a humanitarian perspective. So let me just open my stuff.
Can everyone hear Amal okay, or should I close the...
My voice is usually a little bit low, but can you hear me? Good, perfect. If you want me, just like raise your thumbs up and then. Okay. So Palestinian women movement have a very rich counter-hegemonic feminist organizing. And this goes back to 1921, when the first Palestinian Women's Union was established as the first body of the Palestinian women's activists. Since then, the Palestinian women continuously felt empowered to engage in the struggle of national liberation against the British mandate and later on the Israeli occupation. So Palestinian women have frequently been steamed by nationalism versus feminism paradox, implying that they must strive to convince a patriarchal masculine society of the significance of their social rights and equalities and their right to defend their country at the same time. The Palestinian women's movement emerged from an unsettled political situation in Palestine for sure, which triggered the Palestinian national movement back in time in 1920s and 1930s. So to that extent, it was back in time when the Palestinian movement were activists and they were trying their best to organize all of these efforts and institutionalize it as well. For example, in 1936, it was a historic turning point for the Palestinian women when women's charitable activism became very politicized, owing to women distributing food and medicine to besieged villages in Palestine during the Great Revolt, and that was in 1936. This was the Great Revolt, a very popular uprising against Jewish immigration and expansion of their settlements. So, for example, this photo goes to 1920. This is the Palestinian Women's Association in 1921, which worked in supporting resistance in Palestine and volunteer work. And what I want to do that since the starting point of establishing women activism in Palestine, it was working in parallel with what's happening in Palestine and the political engagement in Palestine as well. This was the first demonstration, women demonstration that happened in Jerusalem back in 1929 against Balfour Declaration and the Jewish immigration. And the Women Association took a very crucial role in this demonstration back in time. So we're speaking about very well-known Palestinian activist back in time who established this important women movement that we are engaged as Palestinian women in it, like Elizabeth Nasser, Hind El Husseini, Zuleikha Shuhabi, for example. And I just like put this example of Zuleikha Shuhaibi because she is the co-founder of the Palestinian women movement. She was very active. She was engaged. Is there someone? Okay. She was also engaged in teaching Palestinian young ladies first aid. She was very keen to educate Palestinian young ladies back then in time. Like a woman and a female activist, which should be also memorized. Palestinian women's participation became visible. And from 1929 until 1947, women's activism was recognized in various media outlets, gaining more prominence. Following the Great Revolt in 1936, the Palestinian leadership was exiled, and many Palestinians were arrested, wounded, and killed. Against this backdrop, Jewish forces in the 1947 experienced a relatively easy route through the Palestinian countryside, and in 1948 it was in Nakba, the declaration of Israel. Palestinian refers to this definitely as a Nakba, the catastrophe, in which upwards of around 800,000 Palestinians, which counts for 80% of the native Palestinian population back then, were forcibly displaced from their homes and from their lands. And as you can see here in the slide, around 15,000 also Palestinians have been killed. And in here we're talking about 1948. So it's very needed to understand the history of Israeli colonization so we can understand what's happening in Gaza at the moment, right? And it's very interesting to understand the historic ethnic cleansing of Palestine to understand what's happening in Gaza at the moment and the continuous ethnic cleansing that it's becoming a ritual for Israel. And this is a book from the ethnic cleansing of Palestine written by Ilan Pappé, a Jewish historian that I'm pretty sure you know about. Plus the destruction, and not only the destruction, the ethnic cleansing of around 530 villages in historic Palestine. So you can see these photos back in time, they're becoming also familiar now, you know, with the tents and the refugees that are happening in Gaza at the moment. But all of these photos were back in Nakba in 1948, but this is also what's happening in Gaza at the moment. So it's history repeating itself. Another important part, the progressive Marxist political emergence in Palestine, which is also a very important political understanding and perspective to speak about the diversity of politics in Palestine, right? So it's not white and black, it's not this group that we have to demolish and whatsoever. No, there's a long, rich history with diverse ideologies and different philosophical political thoughts. And I will be talking about the progressive leftist politicization in Palestine. So after the Nakba in 1948, the emergence of the national movement shaped by the Palestinian identity and proved the importance and the vivid role of political activism for Palestinians, in particular for women as well. In 1964, the Arab League founded the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, to control and, you know, shape the Palestinian activism. The General Union of Palestinian Women, which is the PLO-affiliated women's organization, was founded in 1965. I'm citing Islah Jad here, a Palestinian academic and feminist. Revolution, armed resistance and armed struggle, and steadfastness were not only political strategies, but became crucial principles of nationhood and served as the main discursive touchstones that formed the Palestinian identity alongside a military revolutionary culture, right? Back in time in the 60s and the 70s, because there was the Israeli colonization ongoing and the Palestinian people were resisting, right? Armed resistance and revolution. This is not something new for us. The Palestinian political struggle fragmented into different political parties and organizations. For example, Fatah, which is the PLO's largest faction, dominating Palestinian politics after its establishment in 1950 until Yasser Arafat's death in 2004. This period opened doors for women political engagement, creating space for including women in leadership. A lot of women leaders were taking and playing very vivid roles back in time in this period, and employment, leading to increased economic independence, autonomy, and gender consciousness. In 1967, Marxist secular party called Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was formed, followed by further political Marxist and leftist parties in 1970s. In historic Palestine. These organizations engendered a self-consciously modernizing progressive civic ideology, creating discursive openings for men and women to discuss nationalism and feminism, because we can't separate in between them two. If you're working in feminism issues in Palestine, definitely you'll be engaged in politics and what's happening in Palestine from your different political perspective and ideological thoughts. These parties, the Marxist parties in Palestine, for women's fought for women's social and political rights through associations, through associated women's committees. So each and every political party in Palestine back then, they have this women association that speaks more about the women issues. So it will be part of the whole political left organization or political party. And from 1978 to 1993, so just before Oslo Accords, a new generation of progressive left Palestinians mobilized. Another example is the Palestinian Federation Women Action Committee, which was founded in 1982, was one of the largest organizations demanding equal rights for women in the public spaces through wages, job opportunities, education, and political participation. This left organization focused on the practical, very tiny practical needs of women, including income generation and the provision even of daycare for their children so they can go and participate politically. It achieved success in mobilizing academics and professionals and recruiting working class women through income generating projects aimed at socializing and politically motivating women to acquire an assertive, independent self, independent sense of the self, of being qawiyat, strong. This organization fostered a collective identity and strong feminist consciousness in which women referred to themselves as banat al-amal al-watani, daughters of women's action. This collective identity was fueled by the revolutionary praxis of sumud, steadfastness, in confronting Israeli organization, and I'm talking here about the 70s till now. The spread of sumud, steadfastness, reached the broader community of Palestinians and engaged the social reality in a way that regenerate Palestinian social relations and asserted the intersection in between political, the social, the familial, and the personal. So this is kind of the intersectionality that we do have to understand if we want to knock the door and understand what Palestinian feminist movement means. So, the NGOization, a feminist movement as well, and you know, the NGOization of Palestinian movement also has been affected by international politicized donation of turning the Palestinian women movement into specialized, professionalized, institutionalized jobs. And now we'll be talking about Oslo Accord. Oslo Accord, which took place in 1993, and I personally consider it, among others, another new colonial tie that we're still trapped in. Another critical turning point in here, which compressed the extensively criticized 1993 Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority, and I will be referring here as the PA, the Palestinian Authority, was designated as an interim self-governing body established to govern specific limited Palestinian territories. Within this political arrangement, the Palestinian Authority became economically dependent on donations and guardianship of Israel and the US. The influx of foreign funding led many leftist women committees to follow the agendas of their international donors through a process called the NGOization. Middle class leaders who had previously led the Palestinian resistance movement assumed a bureaucratic, institutionalized role, and the grassroots women's movement was demobilized, which affected what's happening in the feminist scene now in Palestine. Palestinian feminists characterized these as elitist movements that institutionalized and professionalized women's activism, transforming it into specialized, depoliticized work. Sadly, and I think this is a global issue that's happening in different women movement across the world. Following the Oslo Accords, evidence emerged on the growing security cooperation in between the PA, the Palestinian Authority, the USA, and Israel. The associated evolution of the Palestinian Security Forces, the PSF, greatly impacted Palestinian activism. In 2002, the Palestinian Authority was forced to start the Road to Reform, Kharat al-Tariq, aimed at proving Palestinians were credible partners for peace, paving the way for a further reinvention of the Palestinian security forces. These reforms created a monopoly of violence, achieved through a weapon cleansing process from the armed resistance in Palestine, deepening of authoritarianism and the disarmament of military groups committed to the armed resistance of Israeli occupation under the presidency of Mahmoud Abbas, our current president. So this is like some of the photos, right? These are not the Israeli soldiers. Definitely this will not by any mean downplay, right, what's happening in terms of violation and killing from the Israeli occupation part. But it's very important to understand how the Palestinian security forces are also exercising violence upon Palestinian people when they will go out and protest. A primary American-Israeli strategy concerned, so it's an American-Israeli strategy, the Dayton Plan, if you heard about it, concerned funding, manpowering, and weaponizing the Palestinian security forces by implementing Dayton's plan in the West Bank. The Palestinian security forces were trained, right, to persuade resistance elements and gather as much intelligence as possible for arrests to ensure Israel's security in the West Bank. The historical challenges Palestinians have faced impact on more recent activism in the region, including organization of spontaneous protests following the Arab Spring. And this is exactly how the context of this research, because I will be speaking also about the findings of this research, have started. Demanding waves of politically motivated activism emerged in Palestine after 2011, so after the revolution happened in Tunisia and Egypt, demanding free speech, social justice, and an end of the security, coordination, and collaboration and in between the Palestinian Authority and Israel and the economic dependency on Israel. The Palestinian Security Forces, the Palestinian Security Forces is considered increasingly authoritarian, encouraging a culture of militarized policing and lack of respect for human rights and the rule of law. It has arrested members of groups who oppose the officials peace process, particularly suspected supporters of dissenting political parties, including Hamas in the West Bank. Hundreds of civilians have been transferred into military detention without due process, sparking claims of torture and assassination. In June 2021, I will never forget this date, a Palestinian political activist, Nizar Banat, was arrested by the Palestinian Security Forces and tortured to death. He was tortured to death by the Palestinian Security Forces. Thousands of Palestinians, the protesters, and the Palestinian Security Forces intelligence officers reportedly dragged protesters in the street, harassing women. And in here we'll be talking about the intersectionality of feminism, political activism in Palestine. Harassing women, stealing their own phones, and threatening them to publish intimate pictures on social media, and yes, it happened with my friend. Violence and surveillance enacted literally or discursively and manifested in digital or physical forms are routinely exercised over Palestinian citizens, in particular women, because women will be the taboo, women will be the place where this demonstration might end, because it will be a very frightening place that women can go to. They should terrorize this public place, so female activists wouldn't go there and participate. So this is the context exactly of my research, because it was really important just like to lay down and speak about the long history of the Palestinian woman movement, what happened exactly after Oslo, and what is the current situation that we are suffering from as Palestinians in general and as female and feminist Palestinians. So to give you just like general idea about the findings, and this research, by the way, it was published in a very well-recognized Q1 Four Stars journal called Human Relations. It took me 4 years, 2 years to write the paper, and 2 years to go through very tough 3 rounds of revision, but finally it was published on the 7th of January last year, so I'm done with this research, but still, I think it's a milestone that I want to just like build on for further research. So as I told you, data collected in this research from 43 feminist activists in Palestine, in the West Bank, not in Gaza, about their activism in different protests since 2011 until 2019, which has revealed that women activists experience various forms of oppression practiced by the Palestinian Security Forces and its thugs. Thugs, it was a word that was repeated by the Palestinian activists, who are the plain clothes and uncovered police employed by the Palestinian Security Forces, taking the form of physical violence and sexual harassment. The Palestinian Security Forces sought to challenge activist intentions, dimension their political credibility in different ways, and tarnish their reputation and question their moral integrity. Exactly as Selma, if you can just like go ahead the quotes and read that she has experienced physical violence. Yasmin as well, she was dragged in the streets while she is protesting in one of these demonstrations. So physical violence, sexual harassment were not only practiced by the Palestinian Security Forces member, but also by plainclothes police officers, the thugs, as also Reem is saying. So these are like very popular pictures. In here, this is a journalist called Najla, and she was beaten harshly in one of the demonstrations that went out in Ramallah after the assassination of Nizar Banat. And this, so that woman who's wearing red pants, she is employed by the Palestinian security forces as a female plainclothes, so she can be, you know, she can practice her violence maybe easier among women. And this was one of the quotes that Reem said, that she was completely shocked when she realized that there's another woman dragging her and pulling her hair. And she was a woman, and it took her a while just like to understand what's happening. I mean, she got used that they are males, but what's happening here? So this also feminist understanding of how violence is also treated upon these women. Most importantly, and this is how I will make this link in between the collaboration of the Palestinian security forces and the Israeli intelligence units. This tactic, right, of recruiting uncovered Palestinian security force members to harass and arrest women activists resembles methods reportedly used by the Israeli uncover security agents called Musta'ribin. Right? So the Musta'ribin, they are Israeli intelligence units who will be wearing just like normal clothes, enter my own campus, which is Bir Zeit University, and arrest students from there. So our students will be arrested by these Musta'ribin without knowing, what's happening. The security agents are trained by Israeli security units to think, act, dress, and emulate the speech of Palestinian dialect, so that it will be easier for an activist who is in a demonstration just like to speak with you, supposing that you are another Palestinian protesters, and then you will be arrested easily. Their mission is to continuously gather intelligence to arrest Palestinians while pretending to demonstrate with them against Israeli forces. This underlines the growing and non-stop until now security cooperation between the PA and Israel since 2005 to create an Abbas loyal Palestinian security forces directly confronting any dissenting voice, any dissenting party, association, or any form of mobilization. So silencing any voices practically. Palestinian female activists faced a range of measures to control them, exclude them, and shame their bodies by means of proposed dress codes, the way they dress up, death threats, violence, and sexual assaults. The aim of this is clear, disciplinary, right? To disempower women activists by making them feel unsafe in these public spaces, limiting their mobility and use of spaces. So just like go home, go to university, and go work. Politics, you have nothing to do with this. Although the first Palestinian union movement was established in 1921, which was also politicized. So techniques of surveillance and defamation were also taking place digitally, and that was like a new tactic practiced by the Palestinian security forces, which was, to be honest, shocking for me as an interviewer when I heard it from my participants. And just to note, all of these names are not the real names, and they are anonymous names. So techniques of surveillance and defamation were also taking place digitally, with the Palestinian security forces using social media to spread accusations of shame and question the honor of some women activists, and not all, right? In a minute, I will be speaking how the Palestinian security forces treated women inside these movements differently, where we can also better understand intersectionality inside a political mobilization or organization. Activists shared the tactics adopted by the Palestinian security forces to tarnish their reputation online by spreading fabricated sex videos of specific female activists. And we've seen it. So look, X is practicing sex with someone, and she is an activist in this movement. All spread the social media. So you can just like imagine how harmful it was for this female, for this activist, not only one. Such sexual techniques, again, the collaboration in between Israel and Palestinian security, were employed by the Israeli occupation forces during interrogations to subjugate Palestinian women political prisoners, right? The sexual abuse, the sexual assaults, the sexual violation, the harassment that we also heard a lot about from the Palestinian women, females who were arrested from the palace, from the Israeli prisons and jails. Moreover, violence and oppression against women activists did not cease after the demonstrations. So the demonstrations was not the final step. Some activists explained this was when it really started, with the Palestinian Security Forces and its intelligence units investigating personal information about them, including their social status, job situation, political background, friends, associates, and relationship to blackmail them and intimidate them for sure. It is now very interesting to speak about intersectionality and how it took place in inside this movement. As some activists' accounts were made from relatively privileged positions, where modes of expression, appearance, and domestic situations meant they enjoyed slightly better positions in the patriarchal system, affording them a little bit of protection inside the movement from the Palestinian Security Forces. So observations were made such as, and I'm quoting the participants here, although she, another female activist, was harshly beaten in the demonstration, no one chased her or abused her. She is married, she had two sons and one girl. Relatedly, Neda, another participant, explained, I think I wasn't abused that much afterwards, so after the demonstration, as I am a married woman with a child. My family is a politically well-known family in Palestine. No one can touch me. These comments highlight how different patriarchal positions, and this is the new intersection. As a Palestinian researcher looking at the theory of intersectionality, I was trapped by where I will put this intersection. So intersection is telling me about gender, sexuality, race, but patriarchy. My participants are speaking about patriarchal positioning in different way. And I will be speaking about the limitations, both of the theoretical and the methodological limitations of intersectionality as a theoretical framework implied in a context like Palestine. So, these comments by Neda and the other participants highlight how different patriarchal positions resonate, whereby multiple disadvantaged individuals can experience advantage and disadvantage together at the same time. Some women activists believe they were personally targeted because they failed to embody these patriarchal positions. Nai, for example, and I think her comment and quote was very clear to better understand what's happening. Sorry, I should have just put this slide on. So Neda said, because she felt like completely disadvantaged of having any of these privileged patriarchal positions. So first, I'm a divorced woman with two kids. Second, both of my male brothers are political prisoners in the Israeli jails. Third, my dad is an old man, so he's not very well established politician in the Palestinian Authority, for example. Third, my dad's an old man. Fourth, I know that I'm not that typical traditional woman in the way I live. All of what I listed could be considered socially as my vulnerable spots that might weaken me. The security apparatus exploited all of that. It is like I don't have that support system. So this is exactly how I try to understand patriarchy in Palestine. So first of all, it's not generalizing it from an Orientalist perspective of, yeah, there's patriarchy happening everywhere. Because in a minute, I will show you how also patriarchal positioning was also supportive in mobilizing some of these women, because the dad was there in the demonstration and the dad stood in front of one of the police and told them, yo, this is my daughter. (Clears throat) Moreover, and this was something also new, something happened internally inside the movement in between the male activist and the female activist. Gender equalities and power relations were not only produced by institutional social structures, so the Palestinian Security Forces and the PA, but also were sometimes reproduced within protest groups themselves. And here I'm quoting Neda and Jenna, who were speaking about how the male activists inside the movement were gathering, for example, in a male cafe after the demonstration and taking some decisions. So this was also marginalization and exclusion of them as females. So it's not enough what they are experiencing from the Palestinian Authority and their security officers, but still what's happening inside. So women activists would occasionally find themselves subject to male domination in the form of exclusion. Women participants stated that some male activists within protest groups exploited their positions as males. So, for example, they will be the first one who will just like go to the media and speak about the demonstration, or just like decide where to go, when the demonstration will start, when it ends. Oh, this jacket looks a little bit short, make it a little bit long, and all of these small details. And like meeting up in male-only cafes. So in Palestine, back home, we do have this type of male-only cafes where you can enter. I enter it once just like to explore what's happening there, but it's just like very dominated by ahwe. It's like coffee, it's like ahwe, male-dominated kind of public space. Some women activists recounted also, and here I will be coming to speaking about the family so as a unit that forbidden activism for some women, but still as a system that supports some women, as a system that protect these women and mobilize this women. And this part has to do with the emergence of the progressive Marxist political parties that I spoke about in 1970s. It was very clear in the data collection. So some women activists recounted how their family, especially main members, prevented their activism. So you can go out, or like my mom stopped speaking with me if I would just like leave this kind of activism and all of that. But most interestingly, others told alternative narratives that consider the family as a protector, even as a motivator for activism. The counter-hegemonic patriarchal discourse of experiencing family support while remaining politically active, the woman, was shaped by family histories and their varied experiences of colonization and political involvement. Propping this further, it was found that these women activists were influenced by their family, their heterogeneous experiences of political activism, and associated networks. Most belong to the Palestinian lower middle, or working class. Some made comments such as, like, my mom was demonstrating next to me, and I will never ever forget how she was almost going to slap that policeman when he hit me on my head, or when my father. So in here I'm just like trying to analyze how patriarchal system could be looked at from different perspective in Palestine in political activism. When my father knew that I might be harassed, he stepped out with me in the next demonstration supporting me. Or my dad again told a Palestinian Security Force unclosed member after he threatened him that he is proud of his daughter and won't let anyone hurt me. That was so cheerful also to hear from the participants. So women activists born into a politicized family, right? Into a politicized family, particularly a left-leaning one, were upraised by rich, varied experiences of political socialization. I think this is very important to speak about when we're speaking about political activism in Palestine or feminism activism in Palestine. Such experiences should be viewed in relation to the history of women's activism in Palestine, right? Which, under the shadow of occupation, has cultivated a highly educated, politically aware population and a strong feminist movement that's still alive until now. The leftist movement has a history of inspiring and mobilizing the leaders, writers, voices and actions of Palestinian resistance and promoting women's activism. In addition, and in relation to feminist organizing, these activists described how they could be privileged by their left-wing, politicized family support, benefiting from practices and informal know-how. And this is the quote of Abir, I will be citing it again, which enabled them to invade masculinity inside the demonstration, right? To invade masculine domination and other organizational biases of this movement, including exclusion and marginalization. So Abir said, I may not have studied in prestigious schools and universities, but I know quite well how to act on the ground, how to confront, handle dilemmas, and mobilize. The street is the barometer of your know-how in political activism, because she is a politicized activist coming from a politicized left-wing family in Palestine. So this is all about my findings. I think because I've heard that some of the audience also is interested in intersectionality, feminist intersectionality, and I think intersectionality in the global South and how we can imply intersectionality in the global South and in Palestine under Israeli occupation and the Palestinian authoritarianism needs further discussion. So intersectionality. And this is what I tried to do in my human relations paper, which is this research. Intersectionality calls into question the treatment of single identity categories, right? Such as gender, class, race, religion, and sexuality as mutually exclusive, and instead proposes that such categories intersect to create different forms of inequality and opportunity. Simultaneously, going together kind of oppression, has been emphasized as an important dimension of intersectionality that captures these intersections as processes of identity, institutional and social practice. However, and I think this is very important, a careful review and assessment of this fruitful yet challenging merge between intersectionality and diverse fields like gender studies, politics, education, and organizational studies, where I came from, can tell us that the theoretical knowledge and the development of intersectionality is moving faster as a knowledge and as a theory, this is my own assumption, in comparison to the ontological and epistemological advancement of intersectionality as a method. And to be honest, when I read about intersectionality, about the theory of intersectionality, I didn't know how to imply intersectionality. And I would love to hear from you. So where I start from? I collected all of this data. After I did and conducted the 43 interviews with these women, I ended up with different patriarchal positioning. But intersectionality, where does this fit within the intersectionality framework? Israeli colonization, where does that fit in the intersectionality framework? How can I validate, right? How I can validate as a research from Palestine, global South, to the intersectionality theory? Because it's not about race, and it's not about class, it's more about something else, which has to do with the historic, you know, with the historic political long history of these women. So that was a crucial question for me. So it's an issue that has been raised by many scholars who call intersectionality a theoretical buzzword nowadays. So we have to know how to imply it. Yet, with an unrealized analytical and methodological understanding. Therefore, we might be knowing more about this buzzword of intersectionality. And yeah, I'm applying intersectionality. But what do we really have to do is to expand our analytical understanding by questioning how we can further expand our knowledge about intersectionality as a method by questioning the tool. By questioning the tool that researchers are just like having and putting as lenses, as intersectionality, when they will go to the field and explore more. We are using the tools that we are using to analyze our data, categorize our intersections, define axes of privilege and discrimination, which is going to contribute to the future of intersectionality in different scholarly and fields. This research, We assume in this research we advances a theoretical understanding of intersectionality by exploring how systems of gender inequalities are manifested and institutionalized within different organizational aspects. So I can't be looking only at the Palestinian Security Forces as a separate structural entity. I have to better understand how this power is manifested differently in the everyday life of these women. So how gender inequalities are manifested and institutionalized within different organizational aspects, uncovering multiple and much way complex intersectional subjectivities among Palestinian women activists. I don't think I will be covering this. I think we can open the conversation more about the challenges and the limitations of intersectionality as a theoretical and methodological framework when we are studying, I want to say different fields, when we are studying specific politically, economically, socially, social fields that we are exploring. As I told you, there's no way to speak about any topic in Palestine without speaking about Gaza, because it's very crucial, and what's happening in Gaza has to do with what happened in Palestine back in time in 1948. It's the day 149 of continuous non-stop genocide. There's around 30,410 people who have been killed. One third of them are babies, right? And babies are children. There are around 71,700 wounded people. And when I'm talking about wounded people, they're not just like simple wounds. They're just like limbs cut of some people. Israel has conducted and is committed for 16 massacres in Gaza. 40 hospitals so far have been bombed. They are out of service. And definitely you know more about this, and you've seen like horrifying videos all over the social media. There are 130 journalists who have been killed also in Gaza. In terms of the amount of bombs, it's just like traumatic and horrific. Israel has dropped more than 45,000 bombs in Gaza, weighing more than 65,000 tons, making one of the most intense bombing in history against a very, very populated area like Gaza, completely destroyed. I think there's a terminology now, which is educide, speaking about how the Israeli occupation and the Israeli forces are completely demolishing and destroying the educational system in Palestine. So it's edu from education, educide. There's a systematic destruction of the Palestinian universities, almost all universities. This is a photo of Gaza University, which has just like been taken just like few seconds before the whole university was just like demolished on the ground. So almost all the universities in Gaza have been completely destroyed. There are more than 100 Gazan academics and professors who have been killed, and they have been targetly killed. There's a lot of, not research, but media now speaking about the use of intelligence units by the Israeli forces in killing specific Palestinians, including that doctors, academics, and professors. And what's more heartbreaking, that now we're witnessing a humanitarian crisis. A humanitarian crisis. There's mass death and there's continuous starvation in Gaza. There's children that they don't have even food. And there are around 100 children who have been killed. There are infants who are just like eating dates because there's no milk formula. To this situation, the situation is very hard. Now, while we are listening to this presentation, people are starving in Gaza. And definitely, maybe you heard about the flower massacre, where people were just like waiting for food coming out of the truck, and they were killed. And then they will be telling you that Israel is defending itself. How come? I don't know. What we can do, I think we can do a lot. We can bring awareness. We can bring awareness in different shapes and in different venues. We can boycott. We can boycott any affiliation that can support Israel in terms of militarization. Yes, we can boycott. Countries, for example, like Japan and the Danish government, they stop the trading of military to Israel. Governments can do this. A lot of diplomatic issues can be done on this scale. And as an individual, we can bring awareness and we can boycott. Because we know that this is an economic play. We know that it has to do with profits. We know that to keep on going with this ongoing, nonstop genocide, there should be money poured in this violence, in this different form of violence. So we have to keep on going, speaking about this, and not to be ashamed of speaking it politically right. It's Israeli colonization. It's not a war, it's a genocide, right? Killing people, not randomly, systematically. They know that what they are doing. They are ethnic cleansing Gaza. They are depopulating Gaza. What else could be done? When we're speaking about this amount of, all this number of infants and people have been killed, there's a systematic destruction of making living in Gaza. After this, I don't know when this will end, kind of impossible. Thank you.